Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, October 7th, 2003. In the old days, when I was invited to drop in for a chat with Alan Dulles, the CIA was housed in a rambling group of brick Victorian buildings on a small hill overlooking Foggy Bottom. Those visits were like a page out of Agatha Christie. There were always tweedy men like Dulles with him, and the men's faces were lean and handsome, the kind you saw in whiskey ads, leaning indolently beside tall fireplaces in English country houses, or perhaps their Long Island equivalents. Times have changed at the CIA. Headquarters has moved across the river to the enormous complex at Langley, and there is nothing Victorian about the director's office these days. But the fundamental question remains what it has been all along. The tweeds, the pipe, the aromatic tobacco, the fine accents of Boston and Philadelphia were never more than a con. The real face of the CIA is the man with the angle iron, the enforcer. The bottom line at the CIA is blackmail, the squeeze, and killing. Like the mafia, it is a brotherhood where the case officers, those slated to be covert agents, make their careers running paid agents, subverting governments, carrying out assassinations, instigating coup d'etat, corrupting political parties and newspapers, and if they climb high enough up the ladder, running major operations such as the infamous Phoenix program of political murder and execution in South Vietnam that was directed by William Colby and took 60,000 lives. These are the gentlemen killers of the CIA, wrote Harrison Salisbury, the Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times journalist and author, in the May 1975 issue of Penthouse magazine. Our Taking Aim program today is dedicated to Lew Wolfe, whose courage and dedication with the publication of Covert Action Bulletin and then Covert Action Information Quarterly made so many aware of the importance of outing the gentlemen killers of the CIA. Ralph?
Harrison Salisbury was the leading foreign correspondent for the New York Times, chief correspondent in Moscow, and, furthermore, a major spokesperson for official policy all through his long and well-honored career, Pulitzer Prize included, at the New York Times. Indeed, I recall vividly Harrison Salisbury because at the time that we were involved in the International Tribunal on War Crimes in Indochina, Ho Chi Minh and Pham Van Dong asked us to recommend and to arrange an American correspondent to come to Hanoi, one of the first, in fact, the first official correspondents that the Vietnamese were prepared to allow access to areas that were always targeted for bombardment. And after much discussion with Harrison Salisbury, we came to the conclusion that he represented a sector of the class that had come to the view that this war was not advantageous any further to American imperialism. I mention this because Harrison Salisbury, not so long after that, was in the forefront of opposing the nature and character of the specific policy that of which Vietnam was an expression and a paradigm. In his extraordinary article in Penthouse in May 1975, as Maya indicated, entitled The Gentlemen Killers of the CIA, the subheading was, "The agency has always employed murder and subversion."
Salisbury writes that CIA intervention in Chile against the government of the late Salvador Allende was any kind of a freak. The, quote, destabilization of Allende was CIA business as usual. The CIA attempted to destabilize many governments. CIA efforts to topple existing regimes are accurate. Some are public and some are not. Two of the most notorious, notes Salisbury, were the CIA effort in Iran against Mossadegh and then its effort against Sukarno in Indonesia. He notes that the CIA has links to the police departments and especially to the security police of countless countries and to those of every Latin American government. If the chance is to be broken because of a coup d'etat, it is immediately reforged with the new administration. The same is true of all generals and armed forces of all Latin American countries.
The bottom line at the CIA, writes Harrison Salisbury, is blackmail, the squeeze, and killing. Some people have known this simple truth from the beginning. But the CIA has a con, and that con had a lot going for it and was bought by many. He continues, how did the con work? The most comprehensive picture of the hidden mechanisms and inner psychology of the CIA was given by Philip A. Gee, he writes, who was recruited into the company upon graduating from Notre Dame in 1956 and who resigned in 1969, thoroughly disillusioned after 13 years of service in Latin America. Indeed, he cites how Philip A. Gee was brought to the realization of what it was he was conducting for the Central Intelligence Agency, because he describes how the many, many people that he was fingering for the CIA across Latin America were somehow removed from his understanding as to the consequences of their detention, until he was present when he heard the actual sounds of torment as genitalia were being attached to electrodes and the victim going into spasms of agony. It was this confrontation with the concrete meaning of his daily work for 13 years that traumatized Philip Agee and resolved him to break with the crimes of which he had been party for so many years. And Harrison Salisbury writes, the CIA men feel no remorse over the killings, the killing of Premier Mossadegh of Iran, the killing of Che Guevara. These are called targets, and the killing is always carried out with impunity. The fact that the security police of Ecuador, of Uruguay, kill and torture men on the CIA target list had hardly bothered Philip A. Gee until that chance occurrence in the Montevideo police headquarters when he confronted the loud moans coming from the room from the target he had named to the police as a picana, a hand-operated generator applied to the man's genitals, Harrison Salisbury describes.
Let's look at these police chiefs and their assistants. According to Salisbury, and documented by many others, they are brought to Washington to attend the International Police Institute courses and are routinely put on CIA payrolls. The co-option of Latin American armed forces occurs through, quote, training programs, which bring candidate officers to the United States. The ties are kept operative by the CIA and its golden stream of funds when the men go back to their countries. Now, let's look at some of the other methods, which we are going to discuss in further detail throughout the show. Ordinarily, it says, the CIA has its creative talent section, one devoted to concocting forged documents, falsified speeches, and other materials for circulation in the local press. The CIA buys editors and provides them with the necessary copy. Forged documents, for instance, quotes Salisbury, were an important element in the CIA-sponsored overthrow of President Arosemena in Ecuador in 1963. The same technique was used to provoke a diplomatic break between Peru and Cuba. The CIA take genuine materials and insert a few false phrases. Or they take two or three documents, run them together, include a favorable reference to some local official whose reputation they wish to taint, and then the materials surface, possibly in an airport customs examination. Or the CIA plants them with the police to be, quote, found on an innocent victim. The most famous of such concoctions were the Penkovsky Papers, which were a compilation of partly true, partly invented materials supposedly written as a memoir by a famous Soviet double agent. Ralph?
In real life, Harrison Sulbury describes, the CIA resembles nothing so much as a great and closed fraternity. Indeed, it is an arena in which everything is kept secret and kept to itself. All activities are classified as top secret, and people are not allowed to refer to themselves in other terms. They are what are called non-witting individuals, and non-witting is, as Salisbury describes it, the CIA's secret lingo. A witting person in CIA speak means a person in the know, an agency man. No witting man ever talks about technique. He speaks about tradecraft. The lingo is familiar. Safe houses, dead drops, cutouts, flutter, walk-ins, recruits. Cold picks, attempts to recruiting agents cold by walking up to them, infill, exfill, burn and blow, sabotage, the false flag operations, whereby operations are carried out in the name of those you want to demonize, the standard procedure for all major imperial operations, as acknowledged by Salisbury. The men know each other by cryptonyms, code names. All CIA men in clandestine service bear these. A company man, a man's cryptonym, and the nickname stems from this, and this all in the service of murder, of sabotage, of betrayal, of destruction. Destruction of the targets of American rulers. And these are invariably the people who are engaged in movements of social reform, movements for national independence, movements for reclaiming of natural resources, movements for mobilizing the colonially oppressed, movements in opposition to imperial reach. It is that the gentlemen killers of the CIA are mandated to destroy. And like the mafia, he writes, the agency is a true brotherhood. The company will do anything. Lie, cheat, and I quote, steal, kidnap, suborn perjury, bribe, corrupt, subvert, kill, and kill again. If you are of the blood, the company cares for you. If you are not, you are disposable, you are expendable. And Harrison Salisbury, from the inside, writes in Penthouse in May 1965.
75.
The company placement agency finds places suitable to the talents, temperament, and training in their big active department. Of course, there are certain individuals, agents, operatives, hired hands, who are scheduled for termination with extreme prejudice. No employment, no financial benefits are involved here. It's a job for the coroner if the body ever turns up. This similarity to the mafia is noticeable, but the agency terminates its own career employees in the mafia manner whenever they know too much or are possibly about to disclose the right names, the right places, the right accents. The company determines. Having been chosen, you are tested. The company's sister service in England, MI6, for so many years clubbable and cozy that it tested candidates by inviting them to country houses, is no longer the method. These men make their careers running agents, subverting governments, carrying out assassination, instigating coup d'etat, corrupting political leaders, infiltrating and controlling newspapers, and if they are able and shrewd enough, they climb up high enough on the ladder to run major operations such as the Phoenix program of political murder in South Vietnam. It involves political murder. It involves execution on a large scale. It involves rounding up the members of target organizations, of target popular movements, of target students, of target trade unionists, of target cheaters, teachers, authenticated instances of victims being interrogated in helicopters, hurled overboard, a program of political murder that is sustained.
Let's look at some examples. The government of the Shah of Iran was a virtual creation of the CIA, confirmed by Harrison Salisbury. The agency engineered the overthrow of Mossadegh in a coup planned by one of the CIA's most skillful black operators, Kermit Roosevelt. The Shah's security forces were trained and equipped by a succession of American and CIA specialists. For many years, the CIA station chief in Tehran was understood by foreigner and Persian alike to be the second most important man in the country, and many felt he was the most important. He lived in grandiose style, writes Salisbury, in an exquisite suburban villa, and his dinners were a gourmet's delight. The Shah hardly made a move without consulting his CIA advisor. Philip Agee estimated that in a single year, the CIA poured at least $300,000 into the Uruguayan police apparatus in bribes, equipment, and so-called training trips to Washington. Another example cited by Agee was Brazil, where he noted that in a fairly typical election campaign, the CIA had funded 8 of 11 state governorship races, 15 candidates for the Senate, 250 candidates for the Chamber of Deputies, and about 600 candidates for the state legislature. There was hardly a political leader, newspaper editor, student leader, or labor chief in Latin America at the time when Agee was writing who was not approached by the CIA at one time or another. And the CIA attempted to put that person on the payroll. In Ecuador, the legislator who became vice president had his monthly CIA stipend. And the CIA's effort against Allende in Chile did not begin the year or so before his downfall in 1973. It began as early as the early 1960s. The CIA was so heavily involved in fighting Allende in the 1964 Chilean election that the company could not obtain enough Chilean escuderos on the open market to finance its operations. It had to send out an emergency call to stations in Lima, Rio, Montevideo, and other places to buy all the foreign exchange that it could lay hands on. The CIA won in 1964, but in 1970, even more frantic efforts failed to keep Allende from power. His ouster and murder merely culminated a policy that had been applied continuously for a decade.
Maya, the company man, as Harrison Salisbury reveals, enters, quote, an unreal world. He lives his cover. He exists 24 hours a day, 365 days a year as someone else. He is living his lie. His superficial identity may be that of a quiet young U.S. embassy clerk in Ecuador. In fact, he is the tiger who runs street mobs, mobs assembled by local agent for convenient sums paid in gold and deposited in Swiss bank accounts to destabilize a shaky reform government, to enable a bunch of fascist officers to take over, to stabilize the situation through roundups and detentions and systematic torture and killing and disappearances. The standard CIA procedure, increasing the security of their masters and holding back the tidal wave of popular demand for change. A mass of material about the CIA is now available. There's no longer any pretense. There's no longer any grounds for pretended ignorance. The CIA destabilized governments ad seriatim. The CIA efforts have been made to topple existing regimes in all parts of the world. Some attempts are most public, others are not. And he continues, the CIA has links through the police departments into the security police of countless countries, of every Latin American government. The same is true of general staffs, of armed forces, in all those governments that are targeted.
Yes, but the CIA also has close ties to the larger U.S. multinational corporations who collaborate with the CIA in what is a much little investigated area at the time Salisbury was writing in 1975, but has been further investigated since then. Most notably was the relationship of ITT, International Telephone and Telegraph, in Chile. But we have spoken over the past weeks of the relationship of Vanel Vanel, so active now in Iraq and Saudi Arabia. Vanel, as revealed by Wilbur Crane Everland, provided him for cover when he was a CIA operative. As Harrison Salisbury writes, many of these relationships are very long-standing and have been institutionalized over the years. Cover is provided for CIA operations and intelligence is traded. Colby, that's William Colby, often expresses his gratitude for corporate collaboration in his speeches to business groups. The community of interest between the U.S. and multinational corporation was, of course, classically demonstrated by ITT in Chile. Let's look at a specific example of CIA collaboration with corporations. An important article appeared in the International Herald Tribune, January 3, 1978, about the CIA manipulation of the media, entitled CIA Secretly Built, Manipulated a Global Propaganda Network. And it discusses the unremitting, though largely unrecognized, effort to shape foreign opinion in support of U.S. policy abroad, and I'll go on to say, to shape the opinion here in the United States. The agency, according to the International Herald Tribune article by John Crutzen, has channeled information and misinformation through a substantial network of newspapers, news agencies, and other communication entities that are owned, subsidized, or otherwise influenced by the CIA over the years. The CIA employed American reporters as agents, numbered others as sources of information or, quote, assets useful to its operations. And the New York Times did a survey at the time of the CIA's relationships with the U.S. news organizations. Ralph?
As a matter of fact, Maya, the article by John Crutzen, an extremely detailed article, January 3rd, 1978, in the International Herald Tribune, the CIA has refused every demand for detail on its secret relationship with American journalists and foreign journalists and news-gathering organizations across the United States. The CIA has owned and subsidized over 50 newspapers outright. In addition to news services, radio station chains, periodicals, and television stations and other communication entities in this country, overseas, uses vehicles for propaganda efforts, for cover for their operations, and both. Over a dozen foreign-based news organizations and agencies are financed by the Central Intelligence Agency and fully infiltrated by paid Central Intelligence agents. Over a dozen U.S. publishing houses, including the most prominent names in the industry, print at least 250 English-language books financed or produced by the CIA in a space of 5 years. Since the closing days of World War II, over 100 U.S. journalists employed by a score of U.S. news agencies work as salaried intelligence operatives while performing their nominal repertorial duties. Others are employed by the American military, and according to the intelligence revelations as documented here, they are permeating all means of communication throughout the United States, put out by the CIA over channels around the world, including the Italian news agency ANSA, including the news services of countless countries. 34 paragraphs were cited for officials written by counterintelligence experts at CIA headquarters, which were generalized as the news service releases in countries across the world.
Ralph, when William Colby, the former CIA director, was asked if the CIA ever told its agents what to write, Colby replied, quote, "Oh, sure, all the time." In other words, the CIA is the author of official outright fabrications.
Yes, Maya, as Crutzen writes, in the past 30 years, dozens of full-time CIA officers worked to control reporters, non-editorial employees, and all U.S.-owned news organizations. The agency's broad campaign of propaganda is carried out with the awareness that the bogus news stories are treated as genuine, with knowledge, by the U.S. media. Lyman Kirkpatrick, the CIA's inspector general, stated that this was standard procedure. Indeed, the CIA's efforts to mold opinion range from tampering with historic documents to fabricating information to specifying propaganda for furthering the policy aims of U.S. rulers. According to former CIA officials, the agency has long had an early warning network within the U.S. government that advises diplomats and key officials of key stories that have been planted by the agency. There's a mechanism for alerting newspapers and magazines and broadcasting stations as to what is expected of them on a given issue at a specific time, the International Herald Tribune continues. We tell UPI or AP headquarters in the United States when we are planting something. As CIA official says, the stories are transmitted over these agencies' domestic news wires, and they permeate and they continue. Nearly all the American journalists employed by the Central Intelligence Agencies have been used for the collection of intelligence, support for CIA operations, and indeed, such agents become knowing channels of disinformation to the U.S. public, the International Herald Tribune
Ralph,
continues.
You referred to historical record, and a classic example described in this International Herald Tribune article is one that deals with the speech that Soviet Prime Minister Nikita Khrushchev delivered, his secret 5-hour speech to the closing session of the 20th Communist Party Congress in Moscow, from which all foreign delegates had been excluded. And it was in that speech that Khrushchev had attacked Stalin, his predecessor, and he had described him as a savage, half-mad despot. Now, the word went out to the CIA that they could get a copy, that they must get a copy of the text. And by late May, the agency's counterintelligence staff, writes the Herald Tribune, had succeeded in obtaining a text in Poland. A few days later, it was released to U.S. news agencies through the State Department. There was something interesting about that text. The text obtained was an expurgated version, and it was prepared for delivery for the nations of Eastern Europe. And 34 paragraphs of the material had concerning the future Soviet foreign policy had been deleted. And what the CIA did, what it delivered to the U.S. newspapers, was another text containing precisely 34 paragraphs of material on future foreign policy that was written by the CIA counterintelligence experts.
And the article in this regard specifies the following. The thousands of books published by the Central Intelligence Agency in the United States contained propaganda ranging from fiction to outright deception. One such book, the Penkovsky Papers, was published for what the Senate Committee called operational reasons by the Central Intelligence Agency through Doubleday and Company. The book purported to be a journal kept by a Soviet agent, Colonel Oleg Penkovsky, but indeed the information in the book was contrived and compiled by Central Intelligence Agency operative Frank Gidney, an employee of the Chicago Daily News. Quote, it was not a diary. It was a major deception. And indeed, Mr. Gibney conceded that the journal did not exist. This is but one concrete example of a continuing process. Thousands of CIA books, control of publishing houses, permeation of the mass media, the complete penetration of all the main means of communication by actual operatives, operational functioning, subversive operatives who seek to destroy the actual function of a news service by converting it into the propaganda arm of an intelligence service. The current operations of the Shah, Harrison Salisbury continues, the virtual creation of the CIA are but the little continuation of what is done in almost every country.
The Shah of Iran. The work in Laos, for more than 10 years, the CIA ran the secret war and trained the Mayo 15,000 to 20,000 Mayo tribesmen through a command force of 300 to 400 CIA personnel. For more than 10 years, they were running that operation. You name the country throughout the world, and you are going to find the operations of the CIA, whether it's Western Europe, whether it's Asia, whether it's Africa, or Latin America, the CIA is at work. You are listening to Taking Aim with
Rob Schoen
and Maya Schoen on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the Internet at www.wbai.org. Our program today, Outing the Gentleman Killers of the CIA. If you missed this program or would like to rehear it or hear any of our other shows, go to our website, www.takingaim.info, where we have a program archive. We dedicated this program to Lou Wolfe, who began Covert Action Bulletin, which today is Covert Action Information Quarterly. And Lou Wolfe, along with Phil Agee, published remarkable books called, in 1978, Dirty Work, the CIA in Western Europe, edited by Phil Agee and Lou Wolfe, and then Dirty Work 2, the CIA in Africa, edited by Ellen Ray, William Schaap, Carl Van Meter, and Lewis Wolfe. And these over 700-page books, voluminous books, describe in great detail the work of the CIA. But most importantly, they provide a who's who of the CIA operatives. As Phil Agee wrote in the introduction, since the late 1960s and the Vietnam War, the CIA, indeed the entire American government, has faced several of the most brilliant agents who have quit in disgust, and they have told their secrets to the world, especially to the American people. Daniel Ellsberg, a former U.S. Defense Department official, published openly the Pentagon Papers. Victor Marchetti, a top aide to the CIA's deputy director, joined with former State Department intelligence officer John Marks to write The CIA and the Cult of Intelligence. Phil Agee himself wrote his Inside the Company, a CIA diary. And John Stockwell sent his open letter to Stansfield Turner and authored a book, In Search of Enemies. Frank Snepp exposed the last days of U.S. rule in Saigon. And importantly, there was an article that was published in November 1974, in the issue of Washington Monthly in Washington, D.C., entitled How to Spot a Spook. And it was written by John Marks. And in it, John Marks describes how by using public documents, particularly diplomatic lists, in countries throughout the world, it is possible to locate the who is who of the CIA agents, because for the most part they operate under diplomatic cover of the State Department. As John Marks wrote, more than a quarter of the 5,435 employees at the time who purportedly work for the State Department of State overseas are actually with the CIA. In places such as Argentina, Bolivia, Burma, and Guyana, where the agency has special interests and projects, there are as many CIA operatives undercover of substantive embassy jobs as there are legitimate state employees. And then, in other places where the CIA has extensive military operations, such as in Japan and Germany, the CIA embeds its operatives under the auspices of the Pentagon. Ralph?
In How to Spot a Spook, and in the revelatory documents that were the genesis of Covert Action Bulletin, and in Dirty Work, the two books that you cite, the task has been to expose. And Lou Wolfe and Phil Agee went through over 40,000 pages of documentation of State Department publications, U.S. Embassy personnel lists, diplomatic lists of foreign ministries aboard, and other perfectly overt sources, and assembled documents in a global index of CIA operations and personnel available for every every interested scholar, historian, journalist, and political activist who seeks to oppose the secret interventions and killings of the Central Intelligence Agencies. And indeed, in their introduction, Phil Agee and Lou Wolf, these researchers plan a continuing program to distribute regular bulletins worldwide, to report personnel transfers and new assignments. We will seek to expose the CIA attempts to carry out secret operations through its cooperating foreign intelligence services around the world, the operations on behalf of multinational corporations. They set themselves the task of exposing a program of organized murder, of sabotage, of subversion of governments, of destruction of mass movements, of the targeting of leaders of students and trade unionists and peasants for social change, for national independence, for sovereignty, for resistance to their conquest and exploitation by a rapacious imperial power.
By the time Lou Wolf ended the naming names sections of Covert Action Bulletin in October of 1981, 1,000 CIA covert operatives had been exposed. As Phil Agee writes in his introduction to Dirty Work, the CIA in Western Europe, quote, many people still seem to believe the myths used to justify this secret political police force, referring to the CIA. Some of the myths are, of course, actively spread by my former CIA colleagues. Others come from their liberal critics. But whatever the source, until we lay the myths to rest, they will continue to confuse people and permit the CIA, literally, to get away with murder. As he writes, the covert action operations abroad are not sui generis. They happen because they respond to internal U.S. requirements. We cannot wish them away through fantasies of some enlightened president or Congress who would end American subversion of foreign peoples and institutions by the wave of a wand. Only prior radical change within the United States, change that will eliminate the process of accumulating the value of foreign labor and resources, will finally allow an end to secret intervention abroad. Until then, we should expect more intervention by the CIA and multinational corporations, not less. Increasingly important will be the repressive capability of the agency's sister services abroad. End quote. And as we have documented on many of our Taking Aim shows, foremost among those sister services is the Israeli Mossad.
But as Phil Agee and Lou Wolf describe it, the CIA is an action agency above all. Theirs is the area of interventionist action, invasion by Marines. They target the same everywhere. Governments they don't like, political parties, the military, the police, the secret services, the trade unions, youth and student organizations, culture and professional societies, and public information media. The CIA props up its operatives and beats down its opponents. It furthers U.S. hegemony so that American multinational corporations and U.S. rulers can intensify their exploitation of the natural resources and labor of foreign lands. This is their mandate. This is their function. This is their permanent occupation. And he states, there is a myth that the major problem is lack of control, that the CIA is a rogue elephant. This myth comes not from the CIA, but from its liberal critics. Those liberal critics who accept the equation between patriotism and the Central Intelligence Agency's murderous operations, who accept the national interest as that of the ruling class and accepts the we in the United States as embracing the state apparatus of exploitation and murder, as opposed to the we of the many, the working people who are exploited, the working people who are subjugated no less in the United States than in every other part of the world. For the Central Intelligence Agency, its covert operations follow the orders, as Phil Agee and Lou Wolf state, of successive presidents of each National Security Council, of every administrative regime that assumes power in the United States. It is their instrument. It is their operational, functioning murder apparatus. It is not ours. It is not that of the people who they target. It is theirs for the very purpose of carrying out these criminal operations on behalf of a gangster state. And that is the gravamen. That is the point of this mewling, whining, bleating, hands on heart, eyes rolled to heaven, bewailing of the disclosure of the role of Joseph Wilson IV and his operative wife, Victoria Plain. For Joseph Wilson IV was the deputy director of station in Baghdad at the time of the first Gulf War, the de facto ambassador to Iraq, who on behalf of Bush Sr. had been directing Saddam Hussein's invasion of Iran to amputate Khuzestan. A million lives cost in that bleeding war between Iraq and Iran, instigated by Zbigniew Brzezinski on behalf of Central Intelligence, on behalf of the National Security Agency, and continued up to the very moment when Saddam Hussein was ensnared in Kuwait as the pretext for launching the Gulf War long prepared. That is the function that has been continuous, that is described so eloquently in the seminal work of Lou Wolfe and Phil Agee.
Ralph, let's look a bit at Valerie Plain, Wilson's wife, who is a CIA operative. What has come out is that she was working under a corporate identity of Brewster Jennings and Associates. And this first appeared in the Federal Election Commission records, again, a public document, in a form that she filled out in 1999, where the case officer was at the center of the controversy, because she contributed $1,000 to Al Gore's presidential primary campaign at the time, and so her name was revealed, and she had to give her company. But the company, according to the Washington Post in an article October 4th by Walter Pincus and Mike Allen, was, as confirmed by the administration, a CIA front. And in fact, this obscure and possibly defunct, according to the Washington Post firm, who was listed by Plain as on her W-2 tax form in 1999 while undercover for the CIA, it doesn't have a telephone. It is not listed. And the Brewster Jennings and Associates doesn't have an address. The phone listing is not in service, and the property manager at the address that she listed stated that there was no such company at the property. There is no such firm, I'm convinced, according to a government official. CIA people are not supposed to list themselves with fictitious firms if they are under deep cover. They're supposed to be real firms. This sort of adds to the mystery. And that was stated by Robert Novak, who's the syndicated journalist who outed Valerie Plain. Ralph?
The CIA operative Ray McGovern on Pacifica Network disclosed that Wilson was the deputy chief of mission in Baghdad, particularly important to Bush Sr., and he revealed the operations as deputy chief of mission in Baghdad just prior to the 1991 Iraq War and his services to Bush Sr. That is why he was sent to Africa, to Niger, where indeed the former Ambassador Joe Wilson, quote, knew Africa like the palm of his hand, having served in Niger as ambassador and to other countries in Africa. This functioning operative, deputy chief of mission in Baghdad, now in Africa, was sent to Niger to check out the reports about uranium for nuclear weapons coming from Niger to supposedly to Iraq. And indeed, it's instructive that Ray McGovern discloses and states that the real authors of this fake transmission of uranium cakes to Saddam Hussein was the Mossad. He states that the agency understanding of the genesis of this particular operation was the Mossad, and it was based on their knowledge of the operations of the Mossad and who gains. Now, Joseph Wilson had taken his distance from this particular attempt to provide rationalization for the new war on Iraq. And that is the genesis for the outing of his wife as not an analyst for the Central Intelligence Agency, but an operational officer. And that is the genesis as well for the liberal decrying of this, quote, violation of the law. Well, what is it that they are violating, this law that they are to which the liberals are referring? The act was known as the Lew Wolf Act. The act was known as the Suppression of Disclosure Act. It was in fact inspired and determined by George Bush Sr., who was above all determined to prevent the disclosure of the role of the Central Intelligence Agency operatives such as himself, because that is involved in that those operations involve criminal acts of murder, criminal acts of sabotage, criminal acts of overthrowing of governments, criminal acts of killing U.S. citizens, criminal conspiracies against the U.S. against U.S. governmental operations themselves that the CIA and its masters disapproved. So, indeed, the act known as the Lew Wolf Act criminalized the disclosure of the operations of the Central Intelligence Agency in assassinating people across the world, a utter subjugation of free speech and utter destruction of the ability to serve the needs of the many by exposing the crimes of the few, the criminal acts of those who hold state power in this society on behalf of ruling capital.
Well, let's look at the official act, the Intelligent Identities Protection Act. Section 421, Protection of Identities of Certain United States Undercover Intelligence Officers, Agents, Informants, and Sources. Part C. Disclosure of information by persons in the course of pattern of activities intended to identify and expose covert agents. Now, this is an overarching section because it states, quote, whoever in the course of a pattern of activities intended to identify and expose covert agents and with reason to believe that such activities would impair or impede the foreign intelligence activities of the United States discloses any information that identifies an individual as a covert agent to any individual not authorized to receive classified information, knowing that the information disclosed so identifies such individual and that the United States is taking affirmative measures to conceal such individual's classified intelligence relationship to the United States, shall be fined under Title 18 or imprisoned not more than 3 years or both, and there is an imposition of consecutive sentences.
Indeed, 10 years was expected to be the minimal sentence for each individual who was disclosed. Remember, we're talking here about operatives whose criminal activities are being exposed not only to defend the innocent against who these murder operations of the CIA are carried out, but also to alert the American public to what is being done in their name, to alert those who have a right to know that crimes against individuals and crimes against societies and brutal terrorist acts of state are conducted routinely by the Central Intelligence Agency in the name of our people.
In the October 1981 issue of Covert Action Bulletin, the last issue with its volumes of naming names, Lew Wolf did an analysis of the Intelligent Identities Protection Act, and he noted that the bill covers unclassified material, and it's designed to suppress revelations that are derived purely from this unclassified material, public documents. That the bill covers FBI, military intelligence, and other agencies, as well as the CIA. That the bill is not limited to the exposure of government employees. In other words, it covers present and former government employees, agents, informants, and what are called, quote, sources of operational assistance. That the bill is not even limited to names. It speaks of, quote, information that identifies an undercover operative or source. that the bill virtually eliminates any whistleblowing in the intelligence field, and that the alleged protections and any limitations that are stated in the bill are meaningless because, as Lou Wolf states, quote, the CIA and other intelligence agencies have stated many times that the disclosure of any of its personnel or operations impedes its effectiveness. Anything you do, in other words, the CIA says, is an attack on the work of the CIA. Now, it's important to note that the CIA operatives who were exposed, the more than 1,000 operatives who were exposed by Lou Wolf and the people at Covert Action Bulletin, and the 300 operatives exposed by Phil Agee, were not in danger because of being named. Whatever danger that they may have faced, and no danger came to any of them, was because of what they did under their name. It was because of their actions. It was not because of exposing them.
Well, so it's the exposure of the operations that alerts people, but it is what they do that makes them hated and makes them legitimate targets of those who are their victims. Indeed, the Progressive Review on May 17, 1999, disclosed what the meaning of this 1982 Lou Wolf Act was about. Quote, in a major move entirely ignored by the media, the House of Representatives voted to make it a crime to reveal not only the names of current CIA agents, but of former ones as well. The House voice voted mandatory sentencing for those convicted of revealing names. The effect is to provide cover for illegal CIA activity, particularly in the United States. It will be against the law to reveal William Clinton's involvement with the Central Intelligence Agency going back to his Oxford days, George Bush's decades-long affiliation with the CIA before he was named its director, crucial information to reveal the 400 mainstream journalists who work for the CIA, the Washington Post's Benjamin Bradley's work for the agency, the CIA operatives involved in drug smuggling in this country out of such places as Mena, Arkansas, the names of CIA operatives placed in city police departments and in positions as of authority throughout the United States. One of the only restraints on the activities of the CIA is public exposure by the media. It is this very ability to tell the truth, to expose criminal acts, which preserves any prospect of democratic change in this society, the Progressive continues. And what indeed are the criminal penalties for disclosure of clandestine information? The American Civil Liberties Union on October 11th, 2000, we write to urge you to oppose the Intelligence Authorization Act, H.R. 4392. The bill includes provisions taken from the Senate-passed version that threaten civil liberties across the board. It makes virtually all unauthorized disclosure of classified information a felony punishable by a substantial fine and 3 years in prison. The second would legalize authorized intelligence activity that is illegal under the terms of any legislation adopted in the future. And the article of the ACLU goes on to disclose that all of the whistleblowing activity, all of the investigative journalism, all of the exposure of the meaning of Vietnam, of the meaning of the Iraq War, of the meaning of covert operations across the planet, all of this is being rendered illegal, and all of us who are engaged in speaking truth to power are the targets of this legislation, which is designed in a totalitarian manner to shut our mouths, to close our eyes, and to render us complicit in the crimes of our rulers.
Ralph, before we close today's show, I want to return again to the statement in Dirty Works by Phil Agee. His statement that some of the myths about the CIA are actively spread by the liberal critics. And I refer you to an article by William Rivers Pitt, who has authored books against the war in Iraq. And this one, Fair Game, is on 6 October 2003, and it can be found on truthout.org. In it, he refers to the wife of Joseph Wilson, Valerie Plame, as an extraordinary person doing an extraordinary job. And when he talks about her extraordinary job, what he's referring to is, quote, If said CIA operative is working to defend our national security by keeping weapons of mass destruction out of the hands of terrorists, and that is the work of Valerie Plame. And then also he refers to the front companies used to protect the identities of CIA operatives working to defend our national security, and by proxy, all of the agents whose lives are protected by that cover. And he's decrying the fact that they are now fair game as well. Valerie Plame is not defending you and me. Valerie Plame, as so well articulated by Phil Agee and Lou Wolf, is protecting the corporations, the imperial rulers throughout the world.
And Maya, what this means is the following. When The Guardian in London publishes on September 27th, for 50 years, a secretive arrangement had been made to overthrow governments in the world, and it documents the specific assassination plot of Dwight D. Eisenhower and the CIA MI6 plan to eliminate three of the most influential rulers in Damascus assassination plots in 1957. They prelude to the operations across Iraq. Disclosure of this information, the naming of the names of the operatives who carried out these assassination plans in Syria in 1957 are violations of the act. The FBI funded Hamas under Clinton, Haaretz published on the 7th of October, today, this very day. FBI sent money to Hamas while Clinton was negotiating with Y. The FBI Phoenix office, in cooperation with Israeli intelligence, with the approval of Attorney General Janet Reno, was funding Hamas, secretly funding money to Hamas across Gaza and in Lebanon, according to Haaretz. We couldn't publish this today on the basis of this act.
Ralph, the exposure of Valerie Plame by Robert Novak is a falling out among the thieves. It is not an attack on an extraordinary person doing an extraordinary job. You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen.
And we will be back for part two of The Gentlemen Killers of the CIA, when we will disclose George Bush's involvement in Operation Zapata and the Kennedy assassination, the role of the Central Intelligence Agency in the killings of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy, the role of Lee Harvey Oswald as a CIA operative and an FBI operative. We will name the names right here on Taking Aim. We will continue the work that Lou Wolf and Phil Agee have so heroically sustained. We will speak truth to power, and we will not be intimidated by putative acts of suppression, and we will not be influenced by liberal attempts to rationalize these acts by pleading the cause of the operatives of suppression, Joseph Wilson and Victoria Plame.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. You can reach us at 212-209-2953 or 707-552-9995. Our email address is now takingaim@wbai.org. Please note you can reach us at takingaim@wbai.org. Our internet site is www.takingaim.info. We'll be with you next week.
And this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.